State of Arizona Board of Podiatry Examiners. Ms. Ross, would you please take roll call?
Yes. Dr. Campbell?
Present.
Dr. Foreman?
Here.
Dr. Ulano?
Here.
Ms. Broman?
Here.
Ms. Johnson Gray?
She is absent.
We have a call.
Thank you. We'll move quickly to number three, which is board member appreciation. And this is Dr. Ulano's last day here on the board, and we just want to thank him for his service for the past 5 years. Good luck in all your future.
Thank you very much. I learned a lot from everybody, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
We're going to move on here to review and discussion. Pardon me. We have our declarations of conflict of interest. Does anyone have any conflict of any agenda item today? Okay, hearing none, we'll move on to five, which is our review of our board meeting minutes. We have two from March 13th of 2024. We have general session and we have our executive session. We'll start with general session. Does anyone have any corrections or additions? And you had received in your supplement correction on a vote. It was just a kind of a typo error on the graph format for a vote. So I'm sure you all saw that. So hearing that no one has any corrections or additions, I will move to accept the general session minutes from March 13th of 2024. Do I have a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to accept our meeting minutes. General session from March 13th. Is there any discussion? We'll take a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes stand as written. We have also our executive session minutes. Does anyone have any additions or corrections to those minutes? Hearing none, I will make a motion to accept our executive session minutes, seeing that there are no additions or corrections from March 13, 2024.
Second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded to accept executive session board meeting minutes. Is there any other discussion? Hearing none, we'll vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. All right. We'll move on here now to section six, which is our investigation files. We will not be hearing number one, which is complaint 2314-C. We're not going to hear that today. So we're going to move on to 2319-C, which is Dr. Mark Foreman. I'll pass Dr. Foreman to go to the audience. And we have the complainant is present, and as everyone should remember, we only refer to the complainant by initials, and that's our SM, and the complainant should also only refer to herself in that manner. Dr. Foreman is present with his counsel, Cody Hall, and our investigator on this is Dr. Saunders. So we will hear Dr. Saunders' investigation report.
Good morning, guys. 2319C, this is a complaint from SM. She had a complaint against Dr. Foreman regarding complications from surgery. SM, she revealed that she's having some ongoing medical issues still in current treatments, and she feels like the complications were stemming from the initial surgery that a tendon was trapped underneath the plate during thymectomy. She's had multiple procedures since, and she's currently still in workup for RSV. When I spoke with her, diagnosis under tarsal tunnel syndrome, RSV, ongoing neuropathy as well, and in chronic pain treatment. And she provided a pretty good timeline of her events in there as well that we looked through. Dr. Foreman, the attorney, also denied the wrongdoing. This patient was initially seen as a second opinion for surgery. And Dr. Foreman describes the conservative management and surgical treatments that were performed. As said, she was initially seen going through medical records as a second opinion for a said bunion surgery. She was evaluated and management was discussed for x-rays and for a bunion and Taylor sub-bunion, undergoing injection therapy as well. She had multiple follow-ups describing there were no real changes made. And at that time, conservative hours were documented and surgical recommendations and consultations were made. She ended up having a surgical procedure in 2021 in March. She went through a laparoscopy, surgical documentation for EHL lengthening and ostectomy coverage by hand of the fifth ray. The opto specifically does describe an EHL lengthening that was needed during the procedure to aid the correction of the hallux valgus. Previously, it was described for an aching osteotomy condition due to the lengthening of the tendon that was deemed unnecessary at that point and was omitted from the actual surgical plan. Post-op, of course, relatively was normal and eventful. Post-op pain would drop to a level of 2-3 out of 10, and documented in. Patient was doing some cold laser therapy in the office. Standard post-operative care, she was given a splint, cannon boot protection. And in the charts, it's documented that the patient was making some progress. Physical therapy was started as well. A little less than 2 months after the procedure, patient actually was into sneakers. There was some increased pain at that point as she was progressing through. And then, a little after the 2 months mark, a CT scan was ordered to evaluate the healing and some of the pain. Over-the-counter inserts were performed. And there is some documentation at the point that they were considering that there may be a further tendon injury to the EHL. Documentation specifically of that is okay, but there is some notes in there that there was discussion of an additional surgery may be necessary and potentially at the same time remove the hardware at that same juncture of the surgical. Due to the timing of deductibles and insurance, SMG wanted to have it done by year's end. Patient subsequently did go on to have that surgery for the hardware removal. Intraoperatively, there are notes that there are some EHL tears and some scar tissue was documented as well. That patient went on furthermore for post-operative course, normal follow-up care. Continue with some conservative options. Patient required some injections. There was a nerve block done at one point. Cold laser therapy, physical therapy. Throughout the post-op course, after the second, patient was developing some stiffness to that great toe joint that's documented. Ongoing, residual stiffness and pain of the foramen offered at this time documented that SM can go get a second opinion. And eventually she did get a second opinion. She was also followed up to other physicians. When I review the preoperative and postoperative radiographs, the procedures that were chosen are consistent with the standard of care. Outcomes radiographically are acceptable from a clinical perspective. There is some notes that there is some nerve irritation associated with physical therapy. The billing of the procedures are normal, consistent with the procedures that were documented and consistent with the standard of care. When we go through this case, complications, they happen. There's an allegation that Dr. Foreman trapped the tendon underneath the internal fixation. That's primarily what led to all these problems. I think it's unjustified. I don't think that caused problems. Regardless, there's plenty of times in surgery that we actually will put the tendon underneath the plate. Dr. Foreman did perform a tendon lengthening during the procedure as they deemed that was necessary to help get the correction for the hallux valgus, which is consistent, as we know in medicine, there's the bow strung of the EHL and it pulls that big toe over and years of that. So doing a lengthening is very much standard of care. And there are complications that can occur with it. Tendon can re-rupture. I've had that in personal fracture. Develop scar tissue formation, which happened in this case as well. That happens. There's contractures that happen. And how everybody heals is different among patients. So as I say, complications happen. In all cases, both surgeries, informed consent was obtained in both procedures. The documentation is good for this. Treatment recommendations and the care are consistent with the standard of care. It's unfortunate complications happen. She certainly looks like she's going through some of them. I do find that the allegation that the cause of this is Dr. Foreman's fault, I think that it's unsubstantiated.
Thank you for your report. Yeah, when you're talking about the bowstring and the tendon, and this is something that
people have to always remember to be aware of. It's, you know, all those years that that tendon is in that position, it's under a, mechanically, it's under a lot of stress anyway, so it's going to be weakened, and there might, you could very well have micro tears already in that tendon,
yeah.
Which would have, you know, and there could have been, you know, injury to that toe years before that was left untreated that could have caused that. I also just kind of wanted to address, you know, and of course Dr. Foreman enhanced that tendon too when he lengthened it with the products that he used to try to
allograft
to try to help keep it, you know, have it be a stronger tendon. Anyway, this discussion about the neurological aspect of it, and medically I went through and looked at some things in the chart that I think we should be aware of. Of course, the patient mechanically has a flat foot, pronated foot type, so that can lead to a tarsal tunnel, as we know.
Sure.
Also, the patient appears to be postmenopausal or peri or postmenopausal, taking hormones. Women on hormones have a higher incidence, particularly as they get older, higher incidence of peripheral neuropathy from the hormones. It's noted the patient has looks like an alpha drink a day. Well, we can ask the patient how many years, you know, how much. We also, if you look in the preoperative labs at the first surgery, there was a fasting blood glucose of 122. And then again at the second pre-op, 102, it was down. So, you know, there may be, this could have been the heralding sign of an adult onset diabetes could be happening. Another thing I noticed was, I believe it was at the second surgery, the patient was on, had been given acyclovir, which we know is an antiviral. Was there Sjögren's pain? Is that why this was given? So we know that also can create neuropathic pain. So again, that these are complications that can occur from surgery, and we've all had them happen. So I just wanted everybody to remember and think about those medical issues that can lead to having some of these postoperative symptoms and complications. Doctor?
Very well said.
Do you have any other
absolutely. Questions? I mean, unfortunately, surgical healing and outcomes are not always ideal. But Dr. Foreman treated SM within the community standard of care, and he tried to fix what he thought was a problem.
Ms. Berman, do you have any questions?
I guess my only question is, I noticed that because she was unable to do PT because insurance wouldn't pay for it, she had deep tissue massage. And I was just wondering, I've had deep tissue massage personally. That really gets down and also causes inflammation, which can cause a number of issues. And I didn't know whether or not that might have anything to do with this.
I can't say specifically. I wasn't there, but, you know. I have found in my practice that when I send patients to physical therapy and they do hands-on treatment, sometimes they actually cause problems. I'm not necessarily assuming that in this particular case. Some of the most complications that occur in our job is in the recovery room. When nursing does certain things to patients that they're not necessarily supposed to. If patients are overreactive as they're waking up from anesthesia, they're thrashing. Sometimes the nurses will grab their legs and hold them still, and sometimes that causes the most problems. So whether or not something like that done from a physical therapist to the tendon, maybe unlikely, I think, in this
From case. What I read, this is not physical therapy. This was another person, not she did not.
I think...
There was a massage therapist.
There was a massage therapist outside of the medical.
SM can speak for herself on that regard. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure she went to physical therapy. There are no such things called physical therapists. Whether they were getting deep tissue massage, honestly, I don't recall. If they're getting hands-on treatment, but they did see a physical therapist. Can a physical therapist cause some problems? Sure. Anybody can with hands-on treatment. I don't know if that applies in this case. The timeline also, you know, there are some documentations of some of the nerve problems occurring early on. I think the majority of the complications are occurring, or the progression of the nerve problems are coming later on, after the third, fourth surgery. Maybe it progressed after she had some revisional surgeries done at that point. It's hard to say when problems occur. When you're dealing with nostalgia and RSD issues, the mind works in different ways, and 1 + 1 sometimes equals 3, where each one has a cumulative effect on itself and it presents itself later. Or the problem occurs worse after the third revisional surgery. It's hard to answer that.
And there was no any indication in the chart that there was any trauma between the first or the second surgeries from Dr.
No, I mean, patient with, we do these laparoscopic and patients sometimes are more active than not. This patient particularly was in a sneaker by 2 months. That's early, but the scar tissue happens. I don't think, in this case, RSD happens to patients, nostalgia happens to patients. Which surgery caused it, it's very difficult to say. But I don't think it's because a tendon was placed under a plate, allegedly. Dr. Foreman says it wasn't. I don't think that would cause an RSD, regardless of any surgery, you can get RSD in one.
And I think if it was just the tendon sheath, that was not the tendon itself. So you can have tear in a sheath that might have.
Correct. Whether or not that's going to lead to nerve problems, regardless of the surgery, is what I'm saying.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Anything else from any of my board members? Okay, great. So now we will ask our complainant, SM, if you would like to, you can come have a seat, and we will get a summary from you and then be able to ask you questions, all right?
I'll just go ahead and read what I wrote, and then if you have any questions, do that if you accept. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate the opportunity to speak about my experience with my left foot and ankle over these past 2.5 years. When Dr. Foreman performed my lapiplasty surgery on August 27, 2021, he trapped my extensor hallucis longus tendon under the surgical hardware, tearing the tendon in 2 places. After completing 6 weeks of physical therapy and being told to just keep trying for a week, Dr. Foreman finally agreed to a CT scan, which I had on November 18th, revealing the damage. Dr. Foreman apologized to me and told me that he would not charge me for his portion of the surgery I now needed to repair the tendon. He attempted and failed to repair the tendon. At that time, I was distraught and in great pain, including increasing numbness, tingling, and stiffness. He referred me to Dr. Jeffrey McAllister, and I also consulted with Dr. Gabriela Montes. As you have learned, the outcome of my foot surgery experience was the necessity of enduring a big toe fusion and being diagnosed with complex regional pain syndrome type 2. Type 2 means that I have direct damage to my nerves. I absolutely believe that my EHL tendon being compromised caused me to develop the chronic thickening and anterior tibial tendinosis that I've had since my initial surgery. My pain management doctor agrees that the tendinosis likely caused a nerve entrapment, which caused the RPS. Had Dr. Foreman not made this mistake during my surgery, I would not be in chronic pain today. Throughout this ordeal, I have endured 3 surgeries, 1 CT scan, 2 MRIs, cortisone and lidocaine injections, 2 6-week rounds of physical therapy, 1 EMG nerve study, 2 nerve blocks, 1 epidural, 1 psychological evaluation, 1 neurological evaluation, 1 spinal surgeon evaluation, and 1 Abbott DRG spinal cord stimulator trial. I've also endured numerous insurance denials for the above mentioned nerve stimulator, and all because of a mistake Dr. Foreman made during my routine bunion surgery. Prior to foot surgery, I was a healthy, active 49-year-old doing high-intensity workouts, jogging, and walking my golden retriever puppy on a regular basis. I do have no signs of diabetes or any of the medical complications that you guys were discussing earlier. My only complaint upon seeing Dr. Foreman was pain on the outside of my foot due to a tailor's bunionette. My life looks nothing like that now. My husband and I became empty nesters just 2 weeks before my initial surgery. We had plans to travel, spend time with friends, and complete projects that have all been on hold repeatedly because of my continued foot pain. Here's what a typical day looks like for me now. When I first awaken, my mind is immediately drawn to my foot. It feels like an attachment that doesn't belong to my body. It's cold, achy, tingly, and it feels like there's a vice grip around it. I think about how every step I take once I get out of bed will cause me pain. Once I get moving, I'm typically able to put mind over matter and get through a morning that might include some desk work, maybe a low-impact workout, or running an errand. By errands, I'd like to make it clear that a trip to the grocery store is a very painful and difficult task for me now. There's no such thing as walking around a store to browse for fun in my life anymore, and I even have a temporary handicap placard in my car. After about 4 hours, the burning, prickling sensation in my foot elevates to the point that I literally can't think of anything other than ripping off my shoe, sitting down, and massaging my foot. At that point, I'm in desperate pain, and it happens daily. I resign myself to tasks I can do on the couch for a few hours while my foot settles down a bit, but it's not a fun way to live, and all because of a mistake that Dr. Foreman made during my routine bunion surgery. I've described some of my symptoms, but here is a more in-depth description of the pain that I live with every day. Number one is numbness. My entire foot and ankle are numb to the point that it feels like I have a crew sock on when I don't. Coldness. I mean freezing coldness. I use a heating pad when I'm sitting down, and I even take it to work with me the days that I do go into our office. Number three, pins and needles. I have a constant pins and needles sensation throughout my foot that quickly turns into burning feeling after walking any distance. Number four, allodynia. I didn't know what that word meant until I was diagnosed. The feeling of air along the inside of my arch feels like a million bee stings. It's like raw nerve endings going haywire, and it's nails on a chalkboard in terms of how uncomfortable it is. I have to wear a sock even when I wear sandals due to this hypersensitivity. Number five is gripping. It feels as though there is something gripping my foot at all times. I feel tension and pulling in my arch, my ankle, across the top of my foot, and along the bottom of my foot. Sometimes this is so painful that I can't walk. Loss of motor function. My toes don't move correctly, and I have no strength when I try to push them down against my hands. My second and third toes won't touch each other anymore either. It's a strange feeling not being able to move your toes correctly, and all because of a mistake Dr. Foreman made during my routine bunion surgery. Another devastating impact of this journey is financial. To this date, my husband and I have spent $23,761.28 in medical expenses for my foot, not including prescription. Obviously, that amount will increase by several thousand when I receive my permanent nerve stimulator. This far exceeds what we plan to initially invest and has been a difficult amount of debt to assume. One thing that is frustrating about this condition is that it's invisible. No one can see or feel what's going on inside of me and the pain that I'm covering up throughout every day. The one person who understands the most is my husband, and seeing what he has had to go through to keep me going, both mentally and physically, makes me feel awful. He's missed out on all the trips we've had planned, and I can't even go for a walk with him and my dog anymore. But the most frustrating thing about this is that it was 100% preventable. Had Dr. Foreman not made the significant mistake he did, I would not have developed CRPS, and I would not be facing lifelong pain and suffering. Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate hearing from you. I appreciate the fact, too, that you mentioned about the medical issues. You know, these are things that we just see in a chart and we have to ask.
I'm not pre-diabetic, not that.
That's good to hear. Okay, good. And like I said, those other, other things are things that we have to think about in an instance when there is nerve damage. And obviously what you've described is the classic of the chronic atrial pain syndrome. So, and that, again, too, that it's sad that that's a possible complication of any surgery. It isn't anything we can't pick out a patient and say, oh, you're going to get this, or you don't always know. And that's, that's part of the risk of doing surgery. And I know you had a very thorough consent, and these things were discussed. So, and we understand your I certainly understand your frustration. And again, I don't think that, there's nothing malicious going on here. And, Dr. Foreman has done many, many, many of these surgeries, and to having that technique down, I just have a hard time thinking that, that the tendon was put under that plate. But this is my opinion.
Surgical notes say clearly that it was.
It was a sheath, and that's a lining around the tendon. So I think that's part of the problem here, is when a lay person gets a hold of a report and reads it, a lot is conjured up in the mind. And I think that is where some of this whole thing came from, is the description a medical description of a sheath, which is, like I said, it's a lining around the tendon, a piece could be torn and get under there. That's very true, but not the whole tendon. And when the second operative report, you know, just describes the tear, capsulitis, the scarring, which, you know, can bind things to a plate, that's a possibility, you know, that it can bind to the hardware, because hardware, no matter how what materials it's made of, it's always still a foreign object in the body, and there's going to be some reaction to it. And the materials nowadays have a lower incidence of reaction to tissue. So this is, you know, this is part of the whole surgical procedure and how things are picked out, is you're finding things that are going to lessen the chances of issue. The fact that, you know, the tendon was strengthened, and then again in the second procedure, same thing, it was, you know, trying to help strengthen that tendon. Had you had any prior, I mean, this could have been years ago, any prior injury to that?
No.
And in between any of your surgeries, did you have any direct trauma to that?
No.
And you followed all instructions for the non-weight bearing?
Absolutely.
Okay. That's my goal. Ms. Borman, do you have any questions for our complainant?
No, I asked the other one.
Okay. Dr. Yolanda.
Sure. I'm sorry to hear about your client stuff, but unfortunately, surgical outcomes are not always ideal, and we can't predict what's going to happen with patients. And I'm sure if Dr. Borman did the right thing and did what he could for this, the tendon, it was the sheath that was trapped into the hardware, and it wasn't the whole tendon. And sometimes tendons will tear.
Why would my tendon move?
Yeah, it tears. I mean, unfortunately, there's many things that can happen. He put a sheath around the tendon to help it aid in the healing. But unfortunately, things happen. I mean, even people who have tendon repairs will re-rupture. And it's very hard. It's very hard to predict the outcome of that.
I was not led to believe that there was much risk involved, and that it was a real simple, quick repair of that second surgery. So, had I known it was as complicated as it was, and my situation was as complicated as it was, I would not have had him do surgery on me the second time.
Thank you. You can have a seat back, please. Appreciate it. Dr. Foreman, Mr. Hall. Mr. Hall, do you want to speak in, sir?
Excuse me. Yes, good morning, members of the board. Cody Hall from Growing Over with the Wilson on behalf of Dr. Foreman. Just a couple of introductory comments, then I'll turn it over to Dr. Foreman. I think it's been recognized here this morning, and it is true that an unfavorable outcome does not mean the medical care was below the standard of care or unreasonably in any way, shape, or form. The records reflect reasonable and appropriate care and treatment based upon the diagnoses, represent routine and regular informed consent discussions and documentation of that. And the reasonableness of the treatment, I believe, is supported by both the comments here this morning, the narrative response that Dr. Foreman and I submitted, as well as the investigator's report and the summary of the investigation this morning. SM has repeatedly said in her oral statement this morning that all of these problems that she is experiencing occurred because of a mistake Dr. Foreman made during routine bunion surgery. There's no evidence that he made a mistake during the routine bunion surgery, and even a routine bunion surgery can have an adverse outcome for a patient. It does not mean the care leading up to that was the cause of subsequent pain. And with that, I will just renew my request that I believe this complaint should be dismissed against Dr. Foreman. I'll turn it over to Dr. Foreman or any questions that you may have for him this morning. Thank you.
Can I make a comment about your, what you two indicated, you know, that the doctors can make apology to a patient without this indicating an omission of guilt. And I believe the complainant also said Dr. Foreman did not charge her for the second surgery, and that's incorrect. He did. He did not charge her for the laser treatment, is what I read.
He did not charge me for his...
Pardon me, ma'am. You had your time. We're talking to the gentleman now. So this is what I saw in the chart. Am I incorrect?
No, I believe you are correct. And Dr. Foreman can address that more appropriately. And I should address the apology issue as well, because I do think that is significant. Because I've been doing this for 34 years, and it is sad that during these 34 years of time that I've been in law practice, that the legislature had to step in and pass a statute that allows a physician to express sympathy, condolences, to apologize to a patient for an adverse outcome, because doctors, podiatrists, healthcare providers, we're people. They're people. And you know, nobody wants to think that their surgery or their medical care provided did not provide the benefits that they had hoped for. But the legislature passed this statute so that healthcare providers can actually express sympathy, condolences, regret, even to a patient without that being used adversely against him. And again, so. The mere fact that he apologized to her has nothing to do with whether he did the surgery correctly or incorrectly. It has to do with he's a human and he felt bad for one of his patients that she didn't have the outcome that she had hoped for, and that he had hoped for. So, thank you.
Okay. Well, first I'd like to put on record that when doing extensor tendon lengthening, the plate went on before the tendon was in hemostats on the distal and the proximal side, or top and the bottom of the foot. It was not attached. I did not heal, I did not fixate it until the plate was on. So there was no way the tendon was underneath the plate. Okay? It's standard plate procedure not to fixate any kind of soft tissue underneath the plate unless you're using an anchor, which was not used in this case. So after I had fixated the plate, I reattached the tendon. Okay? So there was, when I did the second surgery, the tendon sheath, which was around the tendon, was attached to the plate. Okay, it was scarred down quite, it was scarred down. But in no way was the tendon underneath the plate. Okay, as for my apology, I'm human. I said, I'm sorry that this is happening to you. I did not say that I made a mistake, because I don't think I made a mistake. You know, I'm sorry I'm human, that it was an acquaintance of my wife, and I was sorry that she had to go through this. I offered the free laser, I did bill the insurance, so that was the apology that I gave. And I'll answer any questions that you may have.
Well, we all know anatomically, we all took anatomy, lower extremity anatomy, and we know how, where the tendon runs anatomically. And any kind of surgery you do where you're fixating, soft tissue is not placed under any kind of, you know, just unless you're using an anchor. Yes, that's just, yeah, that is the case. I don't think I have any. Did the patient ever describe snapping or popping, or you just noticed that? Yeah, I mean, that there were, you know, the hear or feel a snap or a pop between the case, the between
nothing.
The,
ever. Nothing.
And did the, you know, my concern again about that high sugar, that high blood sugar, and I don't, you know, that would be, you know, that the primary care I would have hoped would have evaluated that, because to me that's a, you know, when you see, you know, that kind of a increase in a blood sugar on a fasting test, so that just kind of, again, that's just something that jumped out, because you know the inflammatory process of diabetes could have also affected the health of the tendon. So,
can I say something?
No, ma'am. Not now. Hold on. Dr. Yvonne.
Sure. You know, with healing, unfortunately, with healing, when the body heals, it just wants to go in one big mess. And with all that healing, it entraps. And things get tight, and the nerves get entrapped. This is just an unfortunate case. Dr. Foreman did nothing wrong. He did the right thing. Unfortunately, the healing just got entrapped. bad things happen. I'd say, just dismiss this case, 23-19C.
Let me ask Ms. Brown if she has questions for Dr. Brown.
The same one I asked Dr. Saunders. There was a point where, as I was unable to go to the physical therapist and was having deep tissue massage, that seemed to be where some of the problems were starting, because it sounded as if her pain level was one when she was coming to you, and then when she was no longer going to the PT and getting this deep tissue, it seemed to have gotten worse. Kind of a circular thing. She went there because of the pain, and I'm just curious if that could have caused any...
It could have. I recommended going to the physical therapist instead of the massage therapist. And, I understand financial costs, so I can't, you know, it's not my... I can recommend...
Understood, yes. No other questions. Okay, thank you.
Well, again, I think you've heard us all say this is an unfortunate event. It can happen. You don't want it to happen to anybody. It's just, you know, you don't set out to harm people and have things go awry. And an apology from a physician, again, does not indicate there was any malpractice or any practicing below the standard of care. You follow the timeline of things. Things were handled appropriately. Again, there's nothing that, you know, there's just no breaking of the state statutes. Everything was done properly. We really feel, you know, we feel badly, because I have things happen with my patients. Dr. Ulano has, you know, everybody who's ever practiced any amount of time has had things happen. And there's just no evidence of any outright maliciousness or anything like that in this case. So is there any other discussion or comments to be made? And I would ask for a motion.
I have a motion.
Yes, Dr. Ulano.
To dismiss complaint 23-19-D.
No second.
Thank you. So it's been moved and seconded to dismiss case 23-19-C as there are no violations of state statutes. It's made by Dr. Ulano, seconded by Ms. Broman. Is there any other discussion on this? Okay, then we will take our vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion has passed to dismiss the case. Thank you. The complaint is 24-03-D, Dr. Sophia Stocks. I think everybody's pretty, you know, has read this and understands that what happened here. Dr. Stocks did a very good detailed timeline here of what happened. Apparently, the complainant KS was an impatient to Dr. Stocks and thought that she should have the charts, and did not want to speak with the former doctor to get the charts. So Dr. Stocks had bought Dr. Lawton's practice, but that did not include patient charts. So eventually, the patient did get the records from Dr. Lawton. So there was no destruction of records. Everything was followed by statute about retention of records. So, like I said, I think the documentation speaks for itself here, and that I would make a, I will make, does anyone have any questions? I'm sorry, no, for Heather on this. Okay, so, like I said, feeling that the documentation speaks for itself, as there are no violations of state statutes, I would make a motion to administratively close this complaint.
Second it.
It's been moved and seconded to administratively close case 23-C, seeing no violation of state statutes. Have a second by Dr. Foreman. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll take our vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. Thank you. All right. Next we have our license applications. Our first here is Dr. Jason Forney. He had done originally a universal recognition but switched to just our regular new licensee. Everything is in place here. Does anyone have any concerns or questions regarding his application? Hearing none, I'm going to make a motion to accept Dr. Forney's application for initial license here and to issue the license upon payment of the license issuance fee.
Second.
Excuse me. It's been moved. Seconded to accept Dr. Forney's application for initial license here. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So moved. Our next is Mahara Hormuz. This is a standard initial application. Everything is complete in our application. Has anyone any questions or concerns? Okay. Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept the initial license application for Mahara Hormuz and to issue the license upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second it.
Thank you. Moved and seconded to accept Dr. Hormuz's application. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Application is accepted. Dr. Peter Kemp. Dr. Kemp is still in his residency, and so that's the only piece of the information we will need later on. So I will. Anybody questions, concerns here on this application? I'll make a motion to accept the initial license application for Dr. Kemp and to issue the license upon successful completion of the residency program and upon payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
It is moved and seconded to accept Dr. Kemp's application for initial licensure. Any other discussion?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, ma'am.
So he's in his residency now. If there's any issues during the residency, are we told about it and then we would look at it again?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Usually you'll find in applications, you'll see the residency director usually writes a letter and tells you, you know, if they're in good standing and stuff.
But in this case, he hadn't finished that.
Right. Okay. But yeah, they would, yeah, they'd have to report it if there was something that happened. Definitely. All right.
And Madam Chair, Board members, if I may, Ms. Norman, just to further clarify that, it is required before I issue a license to them that they submit their certificate of completion of their residency. So that is maintained in their file.
So any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? So moved. And our next applicant is Rebecca Varney. She is also in her residency and will complete that on July the 1st of this year. Has her residency letter in there. Does anyone have any questions or concerns on this applicant? Okay. Hearing none, I'll make a motion to accept the initial application for Dr. Varney and to issue the license upon completion of the residency program and payment of the issuance fee.
Second.
Moved and seconded to accept Dr. Barney's initial application. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? So moved. Great. So what's that make us? 504 licensees, Heather? something like that. Okay.
We need a number, though.
Huh?
We need a number.
Yeah. All righty. So, okay, next is 7. This is the discussion and action on an update by me from, I gave the yearly lecture to the first year students at Midwestern on April 2nd. Anyway, it was well received. Students had good questions. Basically what I talked to them about is how, you know, particularly initial licensure in this state and some on renewals, but mostly just the initial licensure because that's kind of where, you know, more applicable to where they are in their professional development here. We talk about unprofessional acts and behaviors, so mostly go through the 24 acts of unprofessional conduct, really hit those hard. We talk about the complaint process, how things happen at the board. We talk about how complaints are adjudicated. And then the final is talking about medical documentation, about consent, surgical consent. All right, so next topic is 8 here, and that's with Heather, with the information from the governor's office on adoptions of policies and procedures.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, board members. The board may recall it reviewed the information initially at its March meeting. So I did draft a formal response to the request for information letter from the governor's office. And I also included policies and procedures, some of the policies and procedures the board has already had in place, the complaint procedures and the complaint resolution. I did put together a complaint process flowchart. The sanction grid or disciplinary guidelines was provided at the March meeting. And then that was, that there is a draft with specific actions that could be taken for each violation. So it's just asked that the board look at that, determine if those, you know, that draft is up to standard. And there's also a scoring system that was included. So it's asked that the board, you know, approve this or make any changes if it sees necessary. There is language I'm going to be adding to the disciplinary guidelines sanction grid and to the complaint resolution document. And it'll be under Section 4 of the sanction grid disciplinary guideline document, and it'll be added to the a sentence will be added to the last paragraph of the complaint resolution document, and that language will say, in the event of a conflict between this document and the action by the board, the action imposed by the board shall prevail. So I just wanted to let the board know that I do intend to add that. And again, if any changes should be made, please let me know. Otherwise, it's asked that the board, you know, approve this for submission to the governor's office.
So everybody's reviewed everything. Do you have any additions or anything else you'd like to see on any of the forms, the sanction grid, the...
I think you did a great job.
Oh, thank you.
Did I
could show them a lot of time.
Yeah.
And effort to put into this grid. Thank you.
You're welcome. Oh, we've got to do our job right. So, okay, so on the other one, you know, the other point one, can you, I think, that system, I guess, so what we'll be doing with that is at each meeting, I believe Heather and I will fill that form out because that's part of what goes towards the complaint, you know, adjudicating the complaint process, and that will just be kept in the file, the complaint file. That's the one that has the mitigating, what's the title of that one?
Madam Chair, it's a guide to aggravating and mitigating factors in the determination of disciplinary actions, right? And it would be up to the board to determine if they want to keep that as part of each investigative file, and as Dr. Campbell had mentioned, her and I would be responsible for making sure that gets in the file after each complaint is reviewed by the board.
So if you're, you know, if you think that, you know, if you like that format and it makes sense, you know, it's certainly applicable that today we could, you know, we just, if we don't think we want it, that we need to add anything, and we agree with the language change that Heather just presented, that we can accept, you know, those policies and procedures and then direct Heather to go ahead and submit that to the governor's office.
And Madam Chair, board members, there is still time. The formal response does not have to be submitted until July 1st. So if the board would like changes, modifications, additions, deletions, there's time for that to be done.
So if you want to wait and review again, we'll just make sure, you know, something else.
No, the only thing that I have a question about, and this is something that I asked Heather in the past, when somebody is applying for a license in another state, and they have had malpractice suits against them, in one case $800,000 malpractice, and we give them their license because it's another state, it's whatever. I guess I just have concerns about that without knowing what the background is. Are we going to be causing issues here in Arizona if we basically, they come here and there's nowhere where you could see that there was malpractice in another state that awarded that much? I mean, I understand that for malpractice, sometimes if there is actual malpractice, sometimes they just pay it because of the amount of time. So it's something that as a lay person, I don't understand.
Right. Yeah, because
a lot is a concern.
Oh, and it's a point well taken. You know, when there are settlements that are done, and a lot of times exactly, yes, the cost, monetary cost, doctor cost, everybody's time and cost, that's why a lot of stuff is settled, because things can sit in the court for a long time. And it's not an admission of guilt either, you know. So, and when we have somebody who comes from another state, it's another jurisdiction, they've dealt with it there, and obviously if there's no sanction on that doctor's previous license, because in the questions, that may come up in a question, like usually within the last year, that have they been part of the suit or things like that, that information is there. We don't post that on the website. That's not our jurisdiction. That can't come up on our website. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of people will Google a doctor and see, but you don't get the whole, you don't have that whole story there. Now, you know, sometimes state boards will say, okay, you know, if something is very, very egregious, and maybe if the doctor's trying to run from another state or something and is coming to get it, you can put people on probation. You can deny a license, you can put them on probation and follow people that way. And you look at the time frame on some of these suits that were, you know, 10 and 15, 20 years ago. So, you know, people have, you know, again, moved on. I understand the concern. I think, you know, if a board felt that somebody was, you know, a real danger, that would, you know, that would be alerted. But if you read like the National Practitioner Data Bank report, there would be information about that on there. So we would have that, and that would help in making that determination. But by what we were reading on a previous one we had, that there wasn't anything that was so totally egregious, and there was the one, I believe, where it was such a high amount, the doctor's attorney didn't present himself in the court. So that's probably why that was so high.
And sometimes a malpractice company settles and the doctor doesn't want to, and they're forced to settle because of their contract with the malpractice company. So that's one thing doctors have to look at, that the contractor signing with the malpractice company is not going to settle for them.
So. And Madam Chair, board members, also if that licensee was disciplined in the other jurisdiction because of a malpractice case, we would get that information as part of the application.
Okay. Thank you.
There's always a process. But, and it's definitely learning it over the years to see how things go. But, yeah. And that's why, you know, when we do get complaints, if somebody, you know, and Heather brought it to, like, Seamus and my attention, if something that was happening that was very egregious, and we did have concern for the safety of the public, we can do what's called a summary suspension, which gets them not practice until things can be investigated and addressed. So, yeah, good way to... another protection for the public. So, does that answer your question?
Yes, it was from out of state, in state.
Yeah.
It just seemed like it. So, thank you for explaining that.
All righty. So, we didn't complete that section. So, do you want more time to review things and be sure, as Heather said, this doesn't have to be at the governor's office till the 1st of July. Because we don't want to send something and all of a sudden think we want to add something, right, Heather? They might not like that.
Yes, and I can you know, hold off on sending this until after the May meeting. Again, it's not due until July 1st. I probably, even if the board were to approve it, I would probably hold off just, you know, to consult with some of my colleagues to make sure that, you know, there isn't any additional information that should be added. I also just wanted to point out, too, that on the disciplinary guideline, that sanction grid, that is specific to this board's unprofessional conduct. So every unprofessional conduct that is listed in our statutes is listed on that grid.
And I just want to say thank you, because as a layperson, that makes it a lot easier for me to be able to look at. So I don't have to memorize all of the...
Oh, yeah, it's going to be a tough day.
Okay. I tell you I'm on vacation next week.
So, you know, and Heather, you know, really did a lot of good research and went to, it was Oregon, right, Heather, that you got. So that was a good, gave us a good template to work from. And in addition to the, you know, the other one that we always have in our packet, that kind of has it condensed a little bit, which is another helpful thing. And that, and Heather had something too that she added, you know, that was verbiage that's added on there too. So you see it there, and you see it on the other materials before the sanction grid. So it's in there if we need it. So, you know, maybe, you know, again, like I said, if you want more time to familiarize yourself with things and feel comfortable with it, you know, we can, as Heather said, you know, she was going to withhold it anyway. So, I mean, I guess we could approve it pending any, and if you had any alterations or additions mm-hmm. you want to make, then we can do it, and then she can send it. Mm-hmm. So, you tell me what you all think is.
I think it looks great. I don't think I can make any updates to that.
Just save it till it's due.
Yeah.
Just in case.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll just kind of hold on to it.
And Madam Chair, board members, I would like to ask Mr. Monahan if we need a motion for that.
Yeah, that was my turn. Seamus, are you there?
Yes, I would. Thank you. This is Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I would just formalize it in a motion.
Okay. All right. Then we will do that. So I'll make a motion to accept the policies and procedures that were presented to us in our packets for review, and that we direct Heather to submit the formal response to the governor's office by the due date of July 1st, 2024.
Seconded.
Any discussion? Moved and seconded to accept the policies and procedures that were created for board procedures, and to direct Heather to submit that formal response to the governor's office by July 1st, 2024. Any other discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved. Good deal. It's always good to be ahead of the game and prepared, right? All right, so 9, legislative update.
Thank you, Madam Chair, board members. I'm just going to go over some of the bills that have been vetoed or died or strike everything, and then a couple that I'm going to continue to monitor. So House Bill 2100, which was relating to licensing timeframes, the governor did veto that on March 26th. House Bill 2139 relating to medical records did not pass, so that bill is dead. So is House Bill 2169 is relating to the massage therapy board being consolidated, and that's still in the Senate and awaiting a third read. House Bill 2187 relating to health professions, this is the bill that would require health professionals to use appropriate titles. That bill did not pass the House, so it is also died. House Bill 2243 relating to fingerprinting, I'm going to continue to monitor that. It's in the Senate and is still awaiting a third read. The lobbyists from DPS did let us know that they are working on an amendment for that, which is why it's still awaiting a third read. But we should not be concerned that it hasn't passed yet. House Bill 2308 was amended. This bill allows a person to petition, which was going to be the governor's regulatory review council, but that was amended to say the opposite of administrative hearings, to request a review of a license denial. House Bill 2312 did not pass the House, and that bill has died, and that would just require that a board not keep disciplinary action on its website for more than 25 years. House Bill 2471, this was relating to rulemaking, but it is a strike everything bill now, and it requires boards to submit a proposed or to submit a proposed rule to the Office of Economic Opportunity within 5 years after implementation if the rule is estimated to increase regulatory costs by more than $100,000. And that is still awaiting a third read in the Senate. House Bill 2686, this is one that I'm going to continue to monitor. Myself and a few of my colleagues did meet with the health policy advisor, the health policy advisor reached out to me and a few of my colleagues and asked if we had concerns, and some of our concerns were expressed. We haven't heard anything since then. House Bill 2739 and House Bill 2740 both have died. This was going to consolidate the homeopathic board and the, or repeal and repeal the dispensing options board. House Bill 2761 relating to licensing requirements did not pass and died. House Bill 2846 was related to licensing requirements but became a strike everything, and it now relates to hoop houses and building permits. So it's no longer a health board issue. Senate Bill 1021, this is the scope of practice factors that were repealed, and then 4 new were added. That was signed by the governor on March 27th. Senate Bill 1120, this is a strike everything, and the governor's office is aware that this would cause an issue for health boards. It states that an agency may investigate a complaint, take disciplinary or enforcement action resulting from a complaint only if the complaint has a substantial nexus with the person who is the subject of the complaint. So I will continue to monitor that. Senate Bill 1128 did not pass the House and died. Senate Bill 1365 This is Strike Everything Bill, and it now relates to vapor products. Senate Bill 1725 did not pass the Senate and has died. And that's my summary. So there's a few that I will continue to monitor and bring back, and I can answer any questions.
When do they think session's going to end?
I haven't heard. I initially heard that they wanted to adjourn by the end of March, but I don't even think that they started on the budget yet.
Oh, okay. And at this point, the only thing they can, if they, new bills, they have to be considered what, emergency bills? I can't remember.
Any bill at this point, I believe, could still be a strike everything.
Oh, okay.
But yes, they had to have heard it in committee by, I believe it was March 22nd or 23rd. I'd have to look at the calendar. Otherwise, it would have died. So those bills that are still awaiting a third read were heard in committee. The ones that have died were not heard in committee.
And just for information's sake, when the bill reaches the governor's office, 10 days, right?
To sign, she has 3 days to sign it or veto it. If she does not sign it, then
it becomes
a
law. Law anyway. Right. Just wanted to put that in. All righty. Anybody have any other questions for Heather? Thank you, Heather. All right. Number 10. This is our training from Seamus regarding conflicts of interest.
Just give me one second.
Were you sleeping?
No. Okay, here we go. Conflict of interest. Again, if you have any questions, please feel free to reach out. I'm always willing to do, one-on-one trainings over Zoom calls or anything like that. So if you have any questions, I'm always available. You can reach out through Heather, or you can just email me or reach out to me. So let's get started. All right, conflicts of interest. The ultimate question when it comes to conflicts of interest is to recuse or not to recuse. The object of the conflict of interest statute is to remove or limit the possibility of personal influence which might bear upon an official's decision. The conflict of interest law serves to prevent self-dealing by public officials. The financial interests of public officers or employees must not conflict with the unbiased performance of their public duties because one cannot serve two masters with conflicting interests. Public officials should avoid situations where their professional or financial concerns might conflict with the unbiased performance of their duties. You can find the conflict of interest statute at Title 38, Section 503, and that states, any public officer or employee of a public agency who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any contract, sale, purchase, or service to such public agency shall make known that interest in the official records of such public agency and shall refrain from voting upon or otherwise participating in any matter as an officer or employee in such contract, sale, or purchase. And again, substantial interest. It's going to be a pecuniary interest, such as, a financial interest. It's usually going to be somebody who is a relative. It could be somebody you're a business partner with. But again, either way, the substantial interest is going to be something that's also going to bear upon, your financial interest or your interest as well. So you'll have dovetailing interest in that situation. Any public officer or employee who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision of a public agency shall make known such interest in the official records of such public agency and shall refrain from participating in any manner as an officer or employee in such decision. So when you join the board, you're asked to list any matters that you may need to recuse from due to family members or anything like that. That's kind of the blanket recusal. Again, then in each meeting, if you have a recusal, you announce that recusal, and you fill out a form, which then goes in the board's records. It's very important that you announce these ahead of time. You can even let Heather know before the meeting. It's important too, because if you can't vote, if you're recused, then the board loses that member. It's not abstention, it's a recusal. So if we have a bare quorum and you have to recuse on a matter, we're not going to be able to hear that matter. So when the agenda comes out, if you realize you have a conflict, it would help if you would reach out to Heather and let Heather know. That way she can let the respondent know that, you know, there's a potential conflict and the board isn't going to be able to hear the matter due to it. So when it comes to these conflicts too, these are not, you don't wait until the day of the meeting and then ask to go into executive session to discuss your conflict. That is not a legal matter for the board. That is simply a legal matter for you as an individual member to decide whether you should recuse or not. I will help you. I will talk through considerations with you. I'm not going to tell you have to recuse. That's not my office's role. The recusals are always up to you. Again, though, if it's a substantial interest, the advice I'm going to give is that, you know, you should be recusing from those matters. But again, I'm going to leave that decision up to you. Conflict of interest laws prohibit participation by a public officer or employee in a decision or contract in which the public officer or employee has a direct, indirect, or indirect pecuniary or proprietary interest. A board member who has or whose relative has a substantial interest in any decision of the board has a conflict of interest. So a statutory conflict of interest is one where you have a substantial interest and must publicly disclose that interest and recuse from participating in the matters. So just to kind of drive that home, a substantial interest under Title 38 in general means any pecuniary or proprietary interest, either direct or indirect. And a relative includes spouse, child, parent, grandparent, sibling, or in-law of the board member. When this may come up is, let's say you have a family member who is a podiatrist and they have a matter come before the board. You're going to want to recuse in that matter because of your relationship with that individual and their substantial interest in their own license. Disqualification is automatic and mandatory when statutory conflict of interest exists. Again, so if you choose not to recuse, you're going to put yourself in a very precarious position, and that could open you up to potential criminal or civil liability. A board member must make conflict of interest in any board decision known in the board's official records, may file either a written document with the board disclosing the interest or file a copy of the official minutes of the board meetings which discloses the interest. Again, you know, you have the sheet to fill out at the board meeting, you have the sheet that you fill out once a year that discloses any interest that you know of ahead of time. When you are recusing, again, best practices, if that you're recusing, you don't have to give a long recitation. You can say, you know, simply, I'm recusing from this matter as I know the individual. Or, you know, I have a substantial interest in this matter, so I'm recusing. And then you push back from the table, and best practice is to go sit in the galley with everybody else. A disqualified board member must not communicate in any manner with anyone involved in the decision-making process. So again, that just is kind of an appearance of impropriety. So you just want to make sure that any manner that you're recusing yourself on, you just remove yourself from the board area, sit in the gallery. That way there's no question of, you know, whether you're influencing the board or being involved with the discussion. consequences for violating conflict of interest law. So, you know, when the easiest one is reversal of the board's decision due to undisclosed conflict of interest. So the board's dispositions immediately get called into question when there's not a, when there's a conflict of interest that has not been disclosed. Usually that's going to come when you vote to take action on a matter. And if you vote to take discipline on a matter in which you are have a substantial interest and should be recusing, that is when that decision is going to be then looked at very closely, and most likely you're going to have to reverse that decision or find some way to rectify it, and that may just be holding the matter again. A civil lawsuit filed against the board and or board member to enforce the conflict of interest laws. Civil rights lawsuit filed against the board and or the board members for alleged violations of federal constitutional rights. And criminal prosecution. And when you have a substantial interest and you don't disclose it, the Attorney General's office does not represent the individuals or the board if the board has been advised that it's a conflict and the board moves forward anyway. The Attorney General's office is then not able to represent the board or any of the individual members, and at that point you would then have to go out and pay for your own private counsel. So there's some related provisions, and this kind of goes more towards, you know, gifts and the appearance of impropriety. And so a public official shall not use or attempt to use his official official position to secure any valuable thing or valuable benefit for himself, which he would not otherwise receive in the ordinary performance in his duties, if the thing or benefit might have a substantial and improper influence upon him. And a public official may not directly or indirectly receive compensation for his participation on board in addition to what is authorized by law. So I think that's pretty straightforward. Don't accept dinners, gifts, tickets, tickets to fundraisers from anybody who has or may have a matter coming before the board. Don't accept, you know, one of the easiest thing is, you know, somebody says, oh, let's go to lunch and I'll pay for your lunch. Well, if they have a matter before the board and, you know, they take you out to lunch and pay for your lunch, then, you know, there's a question of whether you were, you know, improperly influenced. And it raises the question of the appearance of impropriety. You know, why are we hanging out with individuals outside the board meeting who have matters currently before the board? Again, that doesn't mean that we're trying to climb into your personal life. If you have friends who are friends and you know, they happen to have a matter that comes before the board, I'm sure this happens all the time. The important thing is to just remember to distance yourself and ensure that you're not having any conversations with those individuals related to their cases. And then bias, prejudice, and predetermination. And what underlines bias, prejudice, and predetermination is, you know, the licensee has a right to due process and a fair hearing. They have a right to only have action taken against them based on the information contained in the board's packet. So one of the things is, you know, do people recuse themselves because they simply read a case and the facts are so egregious to them they don't believe that they can be biased. And without even coming to the meeting, they already believe that this individual, you know, should lose their license or have action taken against them. In those situations, if you feel strongly enough that no matter what is presented at the meeting, you're not going to change your mind, you know, that may be an instance in which you want to recuse yourself or abstain from voting. I will say, though, in those instances, use it very sparingly. You're often asked to make hard decisions here. These aren't easy meetings. You're dealing with people's livelihoods. And it can be easy to say, okay, you know, maybe I just want to step back and take a break from this case or the next case, or, you know, this one's just too much here. It's too stressful, and, you know, I don't know if I can make the right decision. Well, you know, that's why you're here. You're here to make the tough decisions, and, you know, that's why you do it together. And if you need my help again, I'm always there to help you out. But again, any conduct which hinders or prevents the agency from deciding a matter on the basis of its own circumstances is prohibited. Another thing is, you know, some of these cases, they may have news articles, and it's going to be tough not to be able to look at those news articles and incorporate some of those, some of the information in those news articles into your findings. So one of the things you do is you just don't ever do outside research. Don't Google people. You know, this is just like a court of law. The judge and jury are only entitled to make decisions based on what's in the record in front of them. Board members should disqualify themselves if they entertain feelings about the specific facts of the case, which will influence their opinion regardless of the evidence. Board members should also disqualify themselves if they have strong personal feelings regarding the case, as we discussed earlier. Disqualification from the case means that the board member will not participate in either the discussion or voting on the case. This non-participation is called recusal. Another issue for the staff, which is difficult too, you know, pregame ahead of time, we're not always going to know, staff's not always going to know what your recusals are going to be. So it's very likely that you will receive materials for a matter in which you are recused. And, you know, if we know ahead of time, then, you know, that can always be taken out of one packet. You know, maybe it's difficult to do that, but, you know, you're on the honor system here. So one of the most important things is just don't read the materials. If you're going to recuse or you're already recused from a matter and they happen to be in the packet, just make sure you're not reading those or disseminating those. When a board member recuses themselves from participating in a case, it is important to state that on the record at the public meeting, at the beginning of the case, just say, "Mr. Chairman, I will not be participating in this case." It is best practice, as we stated, to leave the board table and return when the case is finished. Ex parte communications. So ex parte communications are communications that you have outside a board meeting. It can be an email or a phone call related to a matter that's before the board. And it doesn't have to be a complaint. It can be a license. It can be a request for, you know, continuing education waivers. And what's most important is that if anybody ever calls you and says, "Hey, I know you're on the board," or, "Hey, we're friends, and I saw you're on the board, I have this matter before the board," best practice is always to send those people straight to the board. Just say, "Look, I can't discuss it with you. You know, reach out to Heather, and Heather would be happy to help you with this." Ex parte communication is an oral or written communication between the decision maker and one party to a proceeding in the absence of the other party. Ex parte communications may indicate a bias or prejudgment that takes the decision-making process. And again, ex parte communications are a reason for, are an appealable issue. So, you know, if we have a matter that goes through and we take action and it's appealed, and one of the matters is that, you know, there was an illegal ex parte communication, that can be an appealable issue, which will overturn the board's decision. It may include communication about a board matter between a board member and a licensee, complainant or applicant, or other person that occurs outside the public board meeting without all parties present. It includes license application matters and contested cases. The board member may not initiate, permit, or consider communications made outside the presence of the party regarding a pending or impending proceeding. So, you know, again, this one's very easy. Just don't talk to anybody about any cases or any board matters or anything that may come before the board. If it's board business, only discuss it at the board meeting or with board staff or myself. ex parte communication with the decision maker is prohibited because it impugns the integrity of the decision-making process and gives the appearance of favoritism. And if you think that people won't call you, you know, I think Dr. Campbell, Dr. Foreman, Dr. Ilano, anybody who's been on the board can tell you that people will call you. Sometimes out of the blue, if they can get your number, they will call you to try to talk to you about their case. And so, again, in those instances, just always redirect them right back to staff. Deprives the absent party of the right to respond and be heard. Can't be misleading because it exposes the decision maker to one-sided arguments, which carries the risk, attendant risk of an erroneous ruling on the law or facts. The board can act only through a majority of a quorum at a public meeting. All board members should have the same information about a board matter. So that's kind of what we discussed. Nobody at the table should have any more information than the other people at the table. The reason for the strict rule against ex parte communication is that the opportunity for bias is minimized if all parties are present whenever any evidence or argument is being presented to the decision maker. An applicant in a license denial hearing and a licensee in a contested case hearing matter are entitled by law to have the board decide their cases based on the evidence presented at the hearing and not by outside ex parte communications. Board members' ex parte communication may in some instances constitute a violation of the due process rights of the licensee or violate the open meeting law. Possible consequences of ex parte communication. Again, the board's final decision may be reversed upon appeal. And if we have a very dangerous practitioner and we're moving through the process quickly in order to punch that license, and we run into an instance like this, that can severely limit our ability to protect public health and safety. Ex parte communication, which violates open meeting law, may nullify board action taken in violation of the law or subject commissioner in question to civil penalty or, in some instances, removal from office. So, again, you know, if you're criminal and civil penalties for violating, these ex parte communication laws, and, you could be removed from office as well. A board member is contacted by electronic means, phone, or in person by outside persons about a license application or a complaint against the licensee, should at the outset refer the contacting person to board staff. Do not listen to information about the matter. Do not say anything other than to refer the person to staff. A board member who does not adhere to those guidelines should recuse when the matter comes on the board meeting agenda. If a member receives such information by mail, forward the mailing to board staff. If contacted by third parties or the press regarding policy issues, board members should proceed with caution. Any opinions or statements given by the board member are on their own behalf, unless specifically authorized by the board to discuss the board's position on an issue with that third party. Board members should be cognizant of whether the communication creates the appearance of favoritism or suggests bias. Best practice is to refer third parties and the press to board staff. If we have high profile cases, you should not be alarmed to if you were to receive any communication from the news. And again, I think it would be in the best interest of the board members and the board for any requests should go through Heather, and that way, you know, it can be discussed and determined, you know, whether that individual, can, should, or will talk to the newspaper. And usually that's going to be as a member of the public, not as a board member. Again, we don't talk to the press about open investigations, and we don't talk to them about board policy. So, again, if the newspaper ever reaches out, please just let Heather know. If it's something you want to do, if you want to give an interview, then maybe we discuss next steps. Contacted by third parties or the press regarding policy issues, board members should proceed with caution. Best practice is to refer third parties in the media to board staff. Remember, no board member has the authority to speak on behalf of the board unless the board expressly gives them the authorization to do so. Without express authorization, Please preface any comments or statements you make with a disclaimer that you do not have the authority to speak on behalf of the board, and anything you say are your thoughts and not necessarily those of the board. In addition to the disclaimer, if you do elect to speak, please be cognizant that your communication does not create the appearance of favoritism or suggest bias. Public officials may not use or attempt to use their position to secure valuable things or benefits for themselves other than the regular compensation provided by the law. It is a class 4 felony for a public servant to solicit, accept, or agree to accept any benefit. At all times, the public servant should conduct themselves in a manner that will ensure no one can contend that his or her vote, opinion, judgment, or other official action was in any way improperly influenced. It is a class 6 felony for a public officer to ask for or to receive any unauthorized gratuity or reward or promise of gratuity or reward for doing an official act. And that is it. So, real easy. Just do the right thing. Keep everything before the board. If you have any questions, let me know. If anybody reaches out to you about a board matter, direct them directly back to the staff. And always mention your recusals beforehand. Let Heather know. Fill out the sheet. And again, if you have a question about a recusal, please let me know, and I'd be happy to discuss it with you. And that's all I got.
I got a question for you, sir. There's an upcoming Arizona State Association meeting. And at the general membership meeting, there's always a report from the state board. So I'm not going to be given it because I'm going to be in Nashville at the Federation stuff. Anyway, so Dr. Foreman's going to give the report. And Dr. Brodus, Executive Director Brodus, has reviewed the report. So and it made, you know, some additions and corrections to it. So my question is to you, can you give Dr. Foreman direction on what kind of questions he should accept, and obviously if there's anything that's heavy lifting that should be directed to the board office. So if there's anything else that you would like to recommend, I'd appreciate that. Because they may jump on him. You know, they try to do that at these meetings. So.
Well, I think again, again, he is giving the board's report, but any action, I think it's easy. Any questions related to how the board may handle something, what the board's doing about this or that, those should be directed to Heather.
Okay.
I just don't want you to get. Oh,
I
know you have, but I just like.
And Seamus, this is. Heather, I just wanted to let you know that the report really is just going over like current events, fingerprint clearance cards, how many licensees we have, the increase in the renewal fee. It's those types of issues that are being addressed. So. And
yeah, absolutely.
And I've already spoken with Dr. Foreman and Dr. Campbell about the fingerprint clearance card that all licensees should just contact me.
Perfect.
Anybody else? Thank you, Taylor.
Thank you.
So what are you going to...
Thank you for your...
What's next month?
I think we're done.
Are we done? Oh, okay.
We're done now.
Good.
And we could start over at the beginning if you want. But.
Save it for 26.
Yeah. Ms. Roman does have a question for you, Seamus.
Yes.
What is GOYFF?
What's what?
GOYFF. It's online. I was just going online and it's conflict of interest and it says when writing to GOYFF staff. It's throughout the documentation from the government. Any idea? It doesn't define it.
No, that's Governor's Office of Youth, Faith, and Family, so I don't know.
Ah, okay.
An interesting question, though. I'm not sure.
Okay. Okay. Thank you again. Okay, so let's move on to Heather's Executive Director's Report.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Board Members. I got some information yesterday afternoon from the Secretary of State's office that the board's role did become effective April 8th, so just this last Monday. It will not be published in the Secretary of State code for a couple of weeks. That's published quarterly, but I will make the changes to the board's website regarding that increase in the renewal fee. Also, the renewal cycle is starting on May 1st. I will send out a mass email on May 1st to all licensees reminding them that the renewal cycle has begun. And this board has always offered a paper application. You know, we've had the board's online portal for the last 5 years. Last year, we moved to Ventia. It seemed to be much more streamlined. At some point, I would like to go completely paperless and require licensees to renew online. So I just asked the board if they would like to continue to offer that paper application for this 2024 renewal cycle, or if we should require that all licensees renew through the online portal. In a situation where a licensee just absolutely could not renew online, they could contact me and I would give them a paper application to renew.
Because you had told me there was like 25% still. 20,
yeah, last year we had about 20 to 25% of licensees still sent in the paper application with a check or a money order. So I have no preference. I just would like to, you know, get the board's opinion.
So you're sending out an email, right?
On May 1st, and I know that CD Broker has already begun
to send out
the email.
Yeah, I
And Ventia should be sending out emails. I believe that starts in May. The email from Ventia starts in May.
So the one you send out, Heather, can you note on there that, yes, we were trying to go paperless, just maybe to give people a little heads up?
I can make it in the body of the email.
Yeah, just tell them that, you know, we're trying to, and hopefully then by that our goal is by 2025-26 cycle that we, or our next cycle that we.
You just, you're urged to.
Yeah.
Apply through the board's only.
Yeah, that way maybe that'll.
Everyone else has left the call.
Another option is to, if somebody is asking for the forms, to send them a link to the forms with a little note saying, if you cannot access this, please contact me, and at that point you can send the form. Because other than that, they'll ask for the form. People like it. But that is a good way to do it so that they're, I don't want to say forced, but it's highly suggested. That's their only way. Just another option. As a technology person, I prefer paperless. I know how people work because I've done many usability tests.
All right.
The only other updates I have is I did provide the current budget. It looks like there's going to be a large remaining ending allotment, but this board just paid second, third, and fourth quarter rent. So that will come down.
Mm-hmm.
So you should see that reflected in next month. And then no new complaints have been added to the complaint log since I sent board materials in, and you should have the current complaint log in your folder. I can answer any questions.
So how many do you, what does our schedule look like next month? I mean, do you
have, I think we'll have four complaints.
Four complaints, okay.
And an initial analysis.
Okay. So next is summary of current events. We don't have anything in that category. We don't have public left to call. Does anyone have anything they'd like to see on future agendas?
I just want to. I got a few phone calls, and I told them to contact Heather about HonorHealth is no longer letting podiatrists do HPs.
Oh.
So I told them to go to the state board because they're going to be the ones handling it. Just wanted to make that aware that if you get a call from
So that's all of the unhoused together.
So they were letting podiatrists do it and they just took it away.
And they have another issue?
I don't know.
Either.
And if I may, I did speak with the licensee and he just indicated to me that it was their policy.
And what is it?
History and physical. So before surgery, you have to do history and physical to make sure everything is going correctly.
So now, will that, again, I wonder, because it used to be, I mean, the anesthesiologist did the H&P, or you brought in an H&P for the PCP too.
That's what I do.
Yeah, that's what.
That and or a hospitalist will be called to see
him. Okay.
Which I assume that's what they want to do.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm sure people will have, maybe some people have an issue with that because of state statute saying that they can do an HMP as long as they can get into the lower extremity.
Welcome to Google Meet. Enter the meeting pin followed by the pound key.
When did that happen?
I just got a call.
Thank you. Oh. You're joining a call with one other person.
Hi, this is Heather. Is this Seamus on the line?
Yes, sorry.
Heather was just, she gave us all her report with the budget and stuff. And Dr. Foreman just told us that he got a call from Honor Health that podiatrists will no longer be allowed to do the H&Ps on their patients.
Wow, interesting.
And Ms. Broman made a suggestion for helping us to convert totally paperless on applications for licensure and renewal. Which was
very good.
Yeah.
So you joined just for adjournment.
We know how you are.
well, perfect.
So our next meeting is May the 8th. And at 8 a.m. And does anyone have any final comments? And again, like I said, this is Dr. Ilana's last meeting.
Thank you, Dr. Ilana.
Everything has been, we've gone through all our agenda items and dealt with them promptly. And so I will move to adjourn this meeting at 9:42 a.m.
Seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? So moved.
So who's taking over the document?
Well, that's what we're
right.
Bye, Seamus.
Yep, great job. I'll talk to you guys later.
Okay, bye, Seamus. You still have to, you know.